Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Almost 50 years ago, Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy met in Chicago for the first televised presidential debate. There were some doubts afterward whether it would ever happen again, and in fact, it was 16 years before the next of these events was held. But now, these high-stakes meetings between the candidates, well, we know that they're a permanent feature of the political landscape, and certainly they capture the attention of both the public and the news media. The question is, do they really help voters decide which candidate will they support, or are they just a form of political theater? Or perhaps the answer is both of those things. This morning we'll be talking about presidential debates and why they become so important in American politics. We'll talk a little bit about the most recent debates involving Senators McCain and Obama, but also talk a little bit about the history of these debates and talk a little bit about some of the dramatic moments that have occurred in past debates. And our guest for the show is Alan Schroeder. He is associate professor in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University. He's written quite a lot about the relationship between presidential politics and the media. He has also worked as a journalist and a television producer, and he is the author of the book Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV. It's now in its second edition, and it's published by the Columbia University Press. So if you're interested, you can seek out the book. And of course, questions are welcome. We give people the opportunity to call in, make comments, ask questions. The only thing that we ask is people try to keep their questions and comments brief so we can keep moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. So either number, whichever works for you, you can call and be a part of the program. Professor Schroeder, hello.
Yes. Hello.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Sure.
We certainly appreciate it. I'm sure now that a lot of people will be familiar with the very first debates, or at least familiar with the idea that they were very important. I think Richard Nixon felt that they were very important in the sense that they worked against him. And I think also that people probably have heard this now famous piece of analysis that said, for people who watched the debate on television, they thought that Kennedy had won. And for people who listened on the radio, they thought that Nixon had won.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, goes to the basic point that you make right at the beginning. And that is, for anything else that these shows might be, they are television shows. And you have to, as you're thinking about what they are and how they work and what they mean, that's something that you always have to keep in mind.
Absolutely. And I think that one of the mistakes that candidates sometimes make, and it's always a little surprising to me that they would make this mistake after being in the arena so long and so prominently as a presidential candidate is, but they tend to regard sometimes the debates as political events rather than media events, or look at them as just one more stop on the campaign trail, not that different from giving a speech or holding a rally or doing a press conference. And the fact is, a debate is a very different and very specific thing, and it's much more like other kinds of television than it is like other kinds of political events. So I think through the history of these things, we've seen that the candidates who understand that it's TV, and Kennedy was the first to figure that out, not the last, obviously. Nixon never quite got that, but those who do figure that out are the ones who are ultimately successful.
And certainly Mr. Nixon had some disadvantages. He wasn't a particularly telegenic fellow. At the time that the debate took place, he was not feeling well, so he was sick, and you know, he was not at the top of his game. But even having said all that, I think the important thing was that Kennedy and his people understood what they were getting into, spent a lot of time prepping for it. He rehearsed. They paid attention to his appearance. And in all these respects, I think they understood the theatrical aspects of this. And it was something that Nixon, maybe afterwards he came to understand, but beforehand he certainly didn't.
He did come to understand it afterwards in a sort of rueful way, because he had figured out that he hadn't quite apprehended it correctly. But that's right. right. The Kennedy people really had a very different conception going in of what the thing was going to be. And I have to give them a lot of credit for that as someone who looks at history, because they didn't have anything to fall back on. You know, I went back and I looked at the newspapers from 1960 to see how the press approached the topic of the first Kennedy-Nixon debates. Believe this or not, there was not a single story in the New York Times or the Washington Post the day of the first debate about the debate. I also watched the newscast, the network newscast for the day that the debate was on. They didn't mention the fact that there was going to be a debate. I mean, compare that with the way it is today, where you get days and days worth of coverage, and the television networks just go crazy with hours of endless coverage. But it shows you that it wasn't just Nixon who didn't quite get what, you know, understand what he was getting into. It was also the news media themselves. And given all of that, that's one reason why I have to give Kennedy and his team even more credit. They figured out something that not very many people understood.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we said afterwards, certainly Mr. Nixon realized that that this didn't help him, and it certainly helped his opponent. If, though, you ask in the larger sense, can we really say that those debates changed the course of the election, or did it sway people who were undecided, or did it really have that kind of dramatic impact?
Well, that's where it gets difficult to determine, because, of course, you can't tease out the debates from everything else that happens over the course of a campaign. And I suppose for some voters, it was the thing that ultimately put Kennedy over the top or made them decide on voting for him as opposed to Nixon. But it's really hard to know that with any certainty. Now, interestingly, Kennedy himself thought that television was what got him elected. He is on record as having said that after he assumed the presidency. And he was all ready to debate again in 1964. He and Barry Goldwater would have gone around the country. That was the plan anyway, and done a series of debates. So Kennedy understood that it was valuable to him. You know, the one time, I think, if we look in American history, the one time where you can look at the debate as being fairly conclusive was 1980. There was only one debate that year between Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter. It was held just a week before the election. That's the latest we've ever had a presidential debate, and there was only one. And for a lot of people who were kind of holding back, couldn't quite make that commitment to Reagan, that debate and the performance that he gave in that debate was what really satisfied a lot of those undecided voters. So I think that's a year where it made a difference. 1960 potentially too, but other than that, has it ever changed the outcome of an election? I'm not sure we can quite go that far.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Alan Schroeder. He's associate professor at the School of Journalism at Northeastern University and has written a lot about presidential politics and the media. He is the author of the book Presidential Debates, 50 Years of High-Risk TV, which takes a look at the history of debates in all their many facets, including all of the negotiations that go on before the debates, how the candidates approach them, how they prepare, how they're covered by the news, the people who ask the questions, all of these sorts of things. It's a very interesting book. So if you're interested in American politics, it's one you might want to take a look at. Questions are welcome. In fact, we have a couple of people here lined up and ready to go here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. First up is someone calling from West Chicago on our toll-free line, and they are line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment and ask a question, too, but I do believe that these, in my personal perspective on this, I think that the conventions and the media basically has turned this thing, especially this year, the last couple of years, into a fiasco. I think most people are tired of hearing it. It's like, get it done and get it over with. I'm looking at these conventions, and I'm looking at, are they necessary? No, I don't think so, because I think what it comes down to is that it's getting so costly, the average citizen wants to know where their money is going. And the second thing is, it may change my mind, whenever they have these programs out there, they never really, they always talk about what they're going to do, but they never say how they're going to do it. You know, if you're going to have one, explain each individual thing you're going to change, and then maybe lay it out on a. I want to revert back to somebody like Ross Perot, at least as crazy as it might sound, he had the diagrams to go back up what he was talking about, and I've yet to see that out of both candidates. And I was wondering if you think there's a need for that now to explain more, since we're like a information technology age, or is it just too much overkill? I'll get off. Thank you. Have a great weekend.
All right. Well, thanks for the comments.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point about Ross Perot. He ran in 1992 and was included in that year's debates. And, of course, he did all of those programs on the air where he was, as the caller said, very explanatory about the specifics of his plan. You know, this would have been an interesting year for a Ross Perot to jump in with all the economic uncertainty. And I think one of the frustrations this year has been that the candidates are still campaigning as though things had not changed to the degree they have. And I know that in the debates, for instance, all of that hit right after the bad economic news really kicked in, and there was a little bit of a disconnect. So I can appreciate the caller's frustration there that maybe some of these issues were not getting addressed in the detail and with the kind of, you know, direct approach that a Ross Perot brought to that process years ago.
I just, the other question was about conventions, and it's sort of a slightly different subject, and yet these have become important television events, although, interestingly enough, what's happened over particularly maybe the last, I don't know, 10 years or something, is that if you set aside something like C-SPAN or CNN, that we're actually, the over-the-air broadcast networks are covering less of them.
That's right.
Because
that's,
I think, right. they realize that they're political. The conventions are held for the party faithful. They're for the people who go to the convention. They're not really for anybody else. And so that perhaps, again, raises some question about, well, just how important these events are, and do they merit the kind of coverage they get?
Well, yes, although, you know, this year it was interesting. We had a little bit of a change from the historical pattern. The historical pattern has been declining ratings, declining interest, the networks, as you say, avoiding coverage, heavy coverage of the conventions. Actually, the convention speeches this year were pretty well watched. The Sarah Palin speech, I don't have the number right in front of me here, but it was a very high rating for a convention speech, and the same with Barack Obama's, and the same with John McCain. Joe Biden's not so much. But I think that in a year where there's a lot of interest in the election, and this appears to be one of those years, and also the outcome is not entirely certain, you know, you don't know going in who's going to win, I think that there is still interest in the conventions. It's up to the parties to make them more about the audience and more about the voters and less about themselves. I mean, as you say, it's a gathering of the faithful, and it's a gathering of people who are there to do party business, but at the same time, it's an opportunity to reach out and get that message across.
Let's talk next with someone here where we are in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, my feeling, and I go back to your original thesis on the debates, and I guess in some way I could segue into the conventions. These are media political events, and they're not crafted in a way to be informative to the voters. I suggest, for example, as voters say they don't know enough about Senator Obama's, he has an excellent website. They wanted to take the time and sit down and go through his various proposals spelled out in detail, to the level of detail you're not going to get on a convention speech and or debate. They would be well informed. I have my reasons to believe why they don't want to do that and continue to claim he's a stiff in a shirt. But be that as it may, I want to try to draw a common thread. You mentioned how the Kennedys were very astute in their advisors in using the 60s debate against Vice President Nixon at the time, and how the debate between Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter was so decisive. And I want to now bring in the debates between John McCain and Barack Obama. Now, granted, I might be presumptuous, but I do think those debates and how Senator Obama from Illinois has performed have validated him to some degree, as they validated Ronald Reagan and as they validated John F. Kennedy. In other words, the country can survive and perhaps prosper with these three individuals, even though one, Kennedy is a Catholic, and we haven't had a Catholic as president. Reagan was a B-movie actor who we thought might not have the firepower intellectually to do the job. And now Barack Obama, dealing with the bugaboo of this country since its inception, he's an African-American. I'd like your opinions on that.
Yeah, I think that those are both excellent points. Let me speak to the last thing you were talking about here, the validation factor. It seems to me that if Obama wins this election, that the debates will have had a lot to do with that in the following sense. They will have ratified him as a plausible president. He will have crossed that threshold in the minds of the voters that allow them to look at him and see him as someone capable of doing that job. And I think the reason for that is because he was so calm and so unruffled and so unflappable during the debates, almost to the point of being a little boring, but I think that was actually part of his strategy compared to McCain, who was very animated and you know, much more sort of lively on the one hand, but not as calm and in control as maybe the country needs at this point, given all of the uncertainty. So I think that analogy that the caller drew between Kennedy and Reagan being validated in the debates and Obama being validated in the debates, I think that there's a lot to that. On the first point, which was also a good one, that the, you know, the debates are limited in what they can offer to voters seeking information, absolutely. You know, the debates show us one side of the candidates, and the debates show us the personal characteristics of the debaters. They give us a clue how they communicate. They give us a clue how they interact with other people, because you get to see them side by side. And they give us a little insight into the leadership strategies and qualities of the candidates. But they don't tell you everything you need to know. And I think any voter who just watches the debates and turns off the TV and doesn't do any more homework is really not getting a full picture. These websites are great for finding out about issues. The news media do a very good job covering, some of the more boring policy issues and things like that. But it's really up to the voters to say, I'll watch the debate, but I also better educate myself in a broader sense, too.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. Let's go to a caller in Indiana on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Two questions. I'd like for you to speak to, particularly in the case of Reagan, speak to him being a movie star and his training as an actor and his exposure to the U.S. community through the General Electric program on TV, who was a spokesman for the right at that time. And yes, secondly, this sort of age we're living in now, I think that the TV thing is much more important than, in a sense, you're giving credit. I think somebody can sit and watch the debates and make a decision that would be a correct one without knowing about too much else about other things also. Thanks.
Okay, yeah. Well, let's talk about Reagan for a moment, and this is a second area that I'm really interested in. I also wrote a book about the relationship between presidents and the entertainment industry, and of course, Reagan is such a key figure in all of that. I spent a lot of time out at the Reagan Library in California looking at different things he had done, including some of these General Electric programs that he did in the 50s. You know, Reagan himself thought that his training as an actor was a big part of his success. When it was all over, at the end of his presidency, he was interviewed by David Brinkley, and Brinkley asked him how being an actor had affected his role as president, and Reagan gave this great answer. He said, you know, I don't see how you could even be a president without first having been an actor. And I thought that was so insightful, and it's true that there's a lot of what you do in that job that is presentational, that is about how you put across your message, how you communicate your message. I think one of the problems that George W. Bush has had as president, and one of the reasons for his low approval ratings, is that he never quite figured out how to talk to the broad mass of the American people. He could talk to the people who agreed with him, but he couldn't persuade the people who didn't. So I think Reagan had that figured out, and Reagan was had that benefit of not just being a Hollywood actor, but also he was a radio announcer in Iowa, and he gave speeches all over the country. So he really knew that aspect of putting on the performance. On the second point about you could watch a debate and make a correct decision, I don't know. I think some people probably could, and I think that it depends on what you're looking for. If you're making a gut decision just based on the personalities, you're certainly going to get a good read on that from the debates. Now, whether that's sufficient, maybe it's sufficient for some voters, that's not sufficient for others. I would like to hope that there's more to it than just turning on the TV for 90 minutes and then making a decision.
You know, one of the things that I was struck by, again, it's in the section where you're talking about the very first debate, is the reaction afterwards, that apparently there were people, and the reaction was very different in the sense that there were some people who said, from now on, all candidates will have to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And then also there were people, and I think one of the people here in the book you quote was Dwight Eisenhower's press secretary, who said something like, no incumbent president's ever going to do this.
Right. That's right. And it actually took another 16 years. After 1960, there were no debates for three election cycles. Only in 1976 did they resume. We've had them in every election since. But the reason they resumed was that you had Gerald Ford, an incumbent, but sort of, you know, just barely, and an incumbent who was not ahead in the polls. And then you had Jimmy Carter, the challenger, who was doing quite well. So Ford saw it in his interest to do a debate with Carter that year. And during the Republican convention in 1976, Ford actually broke from his script and issued this challenge to debate to Jimmy Carter. And that's how the whole thing got started again. But we've seen over the years that incumbents are awfully reluctant to debate. If they think they can get away with not doing it, you know, they'd love not to have to do it. You had the situation in 84. Reagan was a strong incumbent against Mondale that year. He agreed to only two debates instead of the traditional three. And the same in 96 with Clinton and Dole. Clinton was so far ahead of Dole that he basically said, all right, I'll do two debates, but I'm not going to do that third one. What we've seen, of course, in 2000, 04, and now 08 is fairly well-matched candidates. And so they tend to want to, you know, go along for the full ride. And this year, without an incumbent, you didn't have that problem of the incumbent saying, I don't want to debate.
Yeah. Well, given the fact that they're now, they seem to be fairly firmly established as a part of the whole process, can you imagine a candidate simply saying, no, I'm not going to do it?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, and I can't imagine it on the one hand, but on the other hand, let's say you had somebody who was so far ahead, 20 points in the polls or something like that, that they just thought it was too risky and they didn't want to do it. Look, the bottom line is candidates do what's good for their own candidacy and for their own campaign, and much as we'd like to think that there's, you know, this sort of high-minded civic virtue in debates, and that's why the candidates take part in it, they're actually fairly terrified of debating, and I think that, you know, if in a way it's gotten a little out of their control. So could somebody get away with it? Maybe, maybe not. An incumbent president might be able to get away with it in a time of national emergency. You know, we actually saw this year with McCain 2 days before the first debate down in Mississippi saying, you know what, I may or may not show up, because he was quote-unquote suspending the campaign to deal with the economic crisis. So I don't know. I didn't think that went over too well. I didn't think that ultimately benefited him, but it shows you that even in this day and age, even after the tradition is well established, that candidates may, for whatever reason, choose to tamper with that tradition.
Yeah, it just, I suppose it is worth thinking about just how difficult, how challenging this is. I found myself thinking about it actually when I was watching this year's vice presidential debate, when there was so much attention focused on Sarah Palin and how she would do. You know, whatever you think about her positions and her politics, I think you'd have to say that in the debate she rose to the occasion pretty well. And just again, I think about just how hard, and just how the fact that in these debates, virtually every step you take is an opportunity to fall right on your face.
Oh, you bet.
And you know, it seems like there's almost more to lose than there is to gain.
Absolutely. George W. Bush was quoted as saying, it's impossible to win a debate, but it's quite possible to lose one. And I think that there's a lot of truth in that for the reasons that you say. I mean, just think about the pressure on these human beings. For somebody like John McCain, who's been around on the political scene for 25 years, these audiences for these debates were the largest audiences crisis he had ever faced. Same for Barack Obama, same for Biden and Palin. So, you know, you're up against a whole different level of intimidation when you step onto a debate stage.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Alan Schroeder. He is an associate professor in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University. That's in Boston. He's the author of two books, one that we have mentioned. The title is Presidential Debates, 40 Years of High-Risk TV. And the other one is Celebrity-in-Chief, How Show Business Took Over the White House. That book was published in 2004. He's written for a number of publications, including the Washington Post and the Boston Globe. He's been a journalist and a television producer. And we're talking this morning some about presidential debates, those that we've just had and those that have happened now ever since that very first one in 1960 involving Kennedy and Nixon. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One thing that I was interested in talking a bit about is format. And this time around, and I guess now for several cycles, we've had three debates involving the presidential candidates, and each one in a different sort of style.
Right.
We have the traditional guy behind the podium style, which was the very first one. And we've also had the town meeting. And this was something that apparently Bill Clinton came up with, or at least it was a format that he had done as a candidate who he felt this worked well for me. So he said, well, let's do this as a presidential debate. So now that seems like it's also part of the landscape. We've got to do one of those. Who does that benefit? And, you know, does anything come out of that that maybe doesn't come out of guy behind the podium style?
Well, if it's truly a town hall format where the questioning is fairly open, then yes, I think that is a good thing, because I think you get a different kind of questions than you would get if it were journalists posing the questions. But here's the problem, and we really saw that, you know, in stark outline this year. The candidates who negotiate the rules that govern the debates have taken the life out of these town hall meetings. The questioners, for instance, now have to write their questions down on a card a couple hours in advance. The moderator, this year it was Tom Brokaw, goes through and picks out the ones he wants to use. The questioners have to read the questions off the cards. Their microphones are cut the second they finish asking the questions. There's no follow-up allowed, either on their part or by the candidates asking the people for clarification or whatever. So, unfortunately, the town hall debate, which started off in 92 with Bill Clinton and was a pretty freewheeling exchange, there weren't all of these restrictions and rules. Over the years, the campaigns have gotten their hands into it and have tied the hands of the people asking the questions to a point where I thought this year that was the worst of the three debates and the one that was the least illuminating and really did not take advantage. I felt sorry for the people sitting there, and I felt like if this is the people's debate, where are the people? Tom Brokaw was asking way more questions than anybody in that audience, and the people just seemed like terrified little rabbits.
Hmm. The other thing that is interesting has been the coming of the sit down at the table debate,
right?
Which I actually thought of those debates was maybe the most interesting. And again, it does say that the format does indeed matter, because in each case, even though both candidates perhaps were saying some of the same things that they had said in other venues, that the way it's set up does seem to make a difference. And I thought in that particular case also, maybe it gives a slightly stronger hand to the moderator. And I don't know if that's just because the he can practically reach out and touch the guys, or maybe it has something to do with the moderator. I don't know.
Well, you're right. I mean, the format makes an enormous amount of difference, and I think we saw that this year. And I also agree with you that third debate this year, the one moderated by Bob Schieffer, where the candidates were seated at a table, that was the best of the debates by far. You know, for many years, the candidates resisted that idea of sitting down at a table. They always wanted to be behind a podium. They felt a little more comfortable there. But the idea of sitting them down at a table, and then there was another format innovation this year that I think was really beneficial, and that was an open-ended discussion period. So there would be a question asked of Obama and McCain. They would each have a couple of minutes to respond, and then there would be a five-minute discussion period where, for the first time in history, the candidates were actually allowed to talk directly to each other. And I thought that made for a very lively debate in that last debate. You know, they also had that ability in the first debate to talk to each other, although they were standing behind podiums or behind lecterns, but they didn't take advantage of it. They were sort of too afraid to go there. But by the end, in that third debate where they're at the table, and it may have had something to do with the fact that they were in close proximity, boy, they really mixed it up. And I felt like that was a true discussion and a true comparison of the positions and a very lively thing that engaged not just the people on the stage, but also the audience at home.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with some other listeners. And the next is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. I would sort of disagree with this speaker a little bit here. I think the term debate is a misnomer. You know, the moderators on all these debates did not keep the speakers on point, and it degenerated into them just stating their same talking points. It struck me as that they were so highly scripted that you didn't have really any back and forth, and they degenerated to saying the same thing over and over again. Very little new information was presented. So I don't think these are really debates. They're really reiteration of their standard talking points. I'm just curious if you think it might be possible to actually hold the candidates to a real discussion and have a moderator with some teeth who would stop this digression to going back to the same talking points. I'd be interested in your comment on that. Thank you.
Well, yeah, I hear you. And I think that the moderators, there was a sort of a range of moderating this year. I did think that the last debate was fairly well moderated in the sense that the moderator got the questions out on the table and then got out of the way. And there was more direct back and forth between the two candidates in that one. The others, less so. And the vice presidential debate was really problematic in that regard because they had negotiated rules where the response times were so short, it was something like 90 seconds for the initial response and a 1 minute discussion period. Well, 1 minute is nothing. And as a result of that, they were just bouncing boom, boom, boom from topic to topic like a game show. And so I agree with the caller that in that situation, you're not going to get much much detail, and you're also not going to hold the candidates' feet to the fire and really make them address the questions on the floor. The candidates are always going to lapse into their talking points. I just think that they're so programmed to do that that we can't, you know, we'd like to hope they wouldn't, but I don't know that that's a realistic expectation. On the term debate, you're right. These are not debates in the classical rhetorical sense. They are formatted television programs that may or may not allow for a certain level of discussion. But the candidates themselves, again, they're the ones, and their campaign representatives negotiate the rules. They always want somebody in the middle there so that they don't have to do too much direct engagement. They're rather afraid of that.
Mm-hmm. I guess I can't imagine myself running for president, but I guess I can imagine myself as a debate moderator. And this person also, they have a very difficult job. First, the candidates spend all this time and the campaign spend all this time negotiating rules and how the thing's going to go, and then they just go and do what they want anyway. And for the moderator to try to rein in the candidates, that seems like a very difficult, maybe almost impossible and kind of thankless job.
Yes, that's right. And, of course, the moderators also have to be exceedingly fair. If there's a perception that in some way they are favoring one side or the other, or they're giving one side or the other more time, then boy, they are going to hear about that. So they have a thankless job. They're having to enforce rules that they didn't make up, even as the candidates, and you make this point well, are going off and doing whatever they want to. They're violating their own rules left and right.
Urbana is another caller here. They'll be next, line number two. Hello.
I pretty much agree with the previous caller. I don't know whether it's my political leanings, but it seemed to me that, and perhaps because we hadn't heard from her before, that Sarah Palin had a whole bunch of canned speeches that she went through. And she'd even say, I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about this. I don't want to discuss what causes global warming. I want to say this. And It just seemed so blatant to me, maybe because she was less smooth about getting her points across. And it made me feel as though she wasn't able to speak off the cuff, that she had to speak she had to be scripted in order to keep her under control. But I also have to sympathize with the candidates, because if you don't think about and know what you want to say ahead of time and think about the wording is really, really important, because if you have, people will pick up on nuances and twist them and change them and repeat things over and over and over again without, out of context, and making it, so it's really important to try and get your talking points across, given how little time they have.
Right, and the other thing is the candidates don't want to make news in these debates. They don't want to break any new ground. They see debates as a chance to reiterate the positions that they've already formulated and the speeches that they've already given, and maybe reach an audience that hasn't heard all of that before, but they're really not into the idea of coming out with a lot of new stuff, because it's not a very good opportunity to try out new material. It's interesting what you say about Sarah Palin. That when she said that thing in the debate about, I don't want to answer that question, I want to talk about the other thing, I had never, and believe me, I've watched these things over and over again, I have never seen a presidential or vice presidential debate where a candidate has done that, and I was pretty much knocked off my chair by that one. But you know what? I don't think it worked. And I think that the caller here who talked about how canned the speeches were and how frustrating that was, you actually got the information from Sarah Palin that you needed to make a decision, if you hadn't already made it, based on that lack of responsiveness. So even sometimes when debaters do things that are negative or that seem a little bit disrespectful of the voters, you're still learning something about that candidate.
That assumes that you notice that.
I mean, well,
I had an email from a relative who's a Republican, because her father was a Republican, and how wonderful Sarah Palin was. And it's like, she didn't even notice that Palin did this.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, debates are often about reinforcing the things that we already believe about these candidates. There's always a certain little segment of the population that's undecided, but for most of us, I think we watch and we already know who we like, and so we're hearing it in a different way.
Yeah, could be. Thanks.
Oh, thank you. Well, I was struck by, Professor Schroeder, you were talking about the fact that you were just sort of bowled over by Sarah Palin saying, well, I'm not going to answer the question you asked. I'm going to answer the one that I want to talk to, or I'm going to say what I want to, and that no candidate had ever come right out and said that. But the fact of the matter is that politicians do that all the time. Reporters
yep.
ask them questions, and then they simply go on and say whatever it is that they want to say. And sometimes they manage to start with a question and then get to wherever it is they want to go. And sometimes it's even a little bit more bald-faced than that. They just go on and say whatever it was that they want to say.
That's exactly right. There's even a term for this in debate circles. It's called the pivot. So you maybe start with a few words that acknowledge the content of the question, and then you pivot into the thing that you would prefer to talk about. I guess in a way, maybe Palin was being more candid than most by just flat out saying, I'm not going to talk about the thing you asked me. But for me, I think it runs the risk of looking disrespectful to the moderator and also to the voters. You know, if somebody just flat out says, I don't want to talk about this important issue, then I think that has to raise a red flag with a lot of people.
All right. Let's talk with someone else. This is someone in Rankin, and it's line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. Wonderful show. Joined a discussion rather late, so let me apologize ahead of time if you gentlemen covered this. Actually, the timing is perfect because this week, I believe it was on C-SPAN, they had they had Don Hewitt from CBS and I think some of the reporters that actually covered the Kennedy-Nixon debate talking in detail about what they thought. And so I thought that was a very interesting perspective. And actually, on the debate itself, what I recall is that the people who listened on the radio actually thought Nixon had won, whereas people who watched the TV, I guess, felt that Kennedy was all over it. And your comment on the town hall meeting, I think, was very apt. I just remember Bill Clinton being very, very comfortable with that format. And I think it was Bush 41 in one of those debates that actually he got caught looking at his watch, which was quite a to-do about. But my question was, again, about the format. I was wondering if you could speak to having more than two candidates. In other words, you know, three, four people on a stage. I just get an air of a circus atmosphere, and those types of debates I never really get a lot out of. And then finally, I was just curious, have any other countries picked up on this format for their elections as far as the debate open to the public, and how are those perceived? And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, actually, my next project is international debates, and I'm getting ready in a couple weeks to travel to Europe, and I'm going to be looking at how Germany, Holland, and Denmark have done debates, and I'm also going to be doing some traveling in Latin America. What we're seeing is that more and more countries around the world are adopting the American model of candidate debates on television, and that they're extremely well-watched in every country that's ever held them. So there's something to this. You know, I think that people respond, even with all their flaws and with the formats that don't quite work the way you want to and the candidates that are staying on message, there's something about the idea of candidates going side-by-side on a live television program that really appeals to voters, not just in the U.S., but all over the world. On the question of multiple candidates during a debate, of course, where you really see this is during the primary season, where you may have as many as, you know, 10 people on a stage, and it's extremely frustrating both for the candidates who are taking part and also, I think, for the viewers to get more than just a little snippet of what each individual is all about. I think that's one reason why the bar has been set pretty high in the general election debates for candidates being included. A candidate has to have a 15% standing in the polls in order to be included in a general election debate, according to the way it's set up now, anyway. And the only time that's ever happened was Ross Perot in 92. I know this is frustrating to a lot of people who support third-party or independent candidates, but the idea is that the general election debates are sort of the final phase, the World Series, if you will, and that there, you know, you have to sort of work your way up to that level before you could get included in the final debates.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Alan Schroeder. He is an associate professor in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University in Boston and has written quite a lot about presidential politics and the media, including the two books, Presidential Debates, 40 Years of High-Risk TV, and Celebrity in Chief, How Show Business Took Over the White House. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next up, we have someone who is in Urbana, where we are, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Mm-hmm. This is a very interesting subject because the Sarah Palin deal, the Katie Couric interviews were real interesting, where in which she was asked questions, and she basically stood there dumbfounded because she really doesn't know anything, at least according to what I perceive by watching her and having watched her and her debate, her refusal to answer questions, wanting to go off on her own tangent, was sort of, you're right, very disrespectful, not just to the moderator, but to the people that are supposed to be voting for this person. I really don't like her very much, but I'm sort of Democratic-leaning anyway. But I wanted to ask you a question about the Woodward Bernstein, All the President's Men, the supposition was that to follow the money. So if you basically look at how much money Obama's getting versus McCain, because he's limited by his taking federal funds, but also the other people that support these people, don't you feel that the economic crisis, which is truly a global crisis, I mean, the banking systems in a lot of countries have collapsed. Iceland and Ireland and stuff like that basically have huge amounts of money. I mean, trillions of dollars are being poured into banking systems to prop them up. The candidates aren't even addressing this in any real term, other than they're saying, don't panic the populace type of thing. And don't you feel that we don't really get a true representation politically because it's so tied to money? And in Europe, you have less of that, supposedly. And in maybe Asia, I don't know. I'm not sure if I don't follow Asian politics very well. And I agree. I think it's really good of you to go and look at these systems because there might be something we can learn from them. But could you address the issue that money is so corrupted politics? Like, for instance, the Democrat, everybody's called at the Senate yesterday, everybody's accusing everybody of being in the pockets of these banks and these, Wall Street banking systems, hedge funds and stuff like that. Could you address that as really the real problem and not so much the pseudo rhetoric that we get from these politicians and all this other stuff where, they're on talking points, so you don't really learn anything in these debates? Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, there's no doubt that money plays way too big a part in American elections. And, you know, part of the problem is also not just the amount of money, but also the length of the campaigns. Obama and McCain have been out there for nearly 2 years at this point. And to keep an enterprise afloat for 2 years of this magnitude requires millions and millions and millions of dollars. So what they do is they spend as much time fundraising as they do speaking, if not more. And so it does put an awful lot of undue focus on the financial aspect. Now, how that translates into their positions, I think, you know, we can debate that one way or the other. But clearly, anybody who's running for president is—I shouldn't say anybody, but certainly from a major party—you're fairly connected to the establishment and probably aren't going to rock the boat too much by proposing anything too radical. I think in the case of why they're not addressing the issue more on the campaign trail, this economic crisis that we're in, I think for both of them, like everybody in the world, you know, hands are just thrown up. Nobody quite knows how to get a grasp on this. I also think that they're being very careful not to say anything that would rattle the markets even more than they already are, because one of these two men is going to be the next president of the United States, so their words have a lot of power.
All right, let's go to, appreciate the question of the call. Let's go to somebody else, and this is also Urbana and line two. Hello.
Yes, hi. I'm calling. I've been listening for the last probably 20 minutes or so, and I picked up on some of the things that some of the callers have said, and as well as your guest. And, for example, one of the callers said that she didn't think it was good that to have these debates where that people are not told about the questions ahead of time, because then if they are told about the questions, then they can think about them and then basically not say something they'll regret later. And so that's one thing that I think I really disagree with, because, I mean, that's what they have their rallies for, right? I mean, you prepare all these speeches, and that's where you know what's happening. But in the debates, you really want to see how the candidates sort of react to these things that just come up suddenly, right? I mean, that's really what's going to happen once you're in the White House, right? I mean, so these things come up, and you don't have months to prepare for the questions or how you'll react. You sort of have to be up to date on everything. And so I think that spontaneity was removed at some point. And same with the topics that are covered in these debates, right? So these candidates basically limit what topics can be covered. And so that's why you don't get to hear some topics that most of people might be interested in, because the candidates and the Democrats and the Republicans, they actually, the former chairs are the chairs of the Commission on Presidential Debates. So they actually decide how everything is set up, right, including who gets invited. So basically, the public here has allowed these two parties to control everything that's said, not only in the campaign trail, but also in these debates. And so if you get some other parties, and I don't know if your guests watched last night's third-party debate, where even one of the candidates were allowed to ask each other questions, which that really would put these candidates on their feet, right? And so what does your guest think about having these sort of other options where the candidates can ask each other questions and basically open up this possibility for real discussion, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot to chew on there. The idea of asking each other questions, I like that. I think that would be a very interesting thing to do in a general election debate. And I also quite agree with your point here that what we want to see in a debate is some sense of spontaneity, because what we want to see is a test of how this person would react under pressure in a White House situation. And it's hard to simulate that, but anything spontaneous gives us some of an idea. But let me just be clear on one thing. The questions are chosen by the moderator, not the debate sponsors. The thing is, the candidates and their campaigns can pretty well anticipate what's going to be asked. So they prepare the candidates very thoroughly, and it's quite unusual for them to ever be surprised by a question. I didn't hear any questions this year that I thought the candidates weren't prepared for. Back in 2004, Bob Schieffer was a moderator in a Bush-Kerry debate. He asked them, is homosexuality a choice or is it genetic? And that really threw them both off. They really weren't prepared for that, and they didn't give very good answers, either one of them.
Well, this year in the primary, at least, we saw some interesting kind of innovations. I think most of them aimed at the idea that we'd like to get more citizen participation in these, in a sense of getting people the chance to ask the questions. Other than that, though, it seems that in their form, these debates haven't really changed very much since 1960. Is it likely, do you think, in the future that, I'm sure we'll continue to have them, but is it likely, do you think, that we might see something, some significant sort of change that might, in fact, address some of the concerns that people have about whether, in fact, that they have there's enough meat here, you know, in these things for people?
Yes, I do think that changes are in store, and we did see a lot of experimentation this year in the primary debates. The YouTube debates, for instance, were a good example of getting citizens involved. Some of it was a little goofy, but I think it's, on balance, a good thing. You know, television back in 1960 was really new, and the debates were an outgrowth of the beginning of the television age, but we haven't quite moved into the Internet age, and I think that's got to be just around the corner when we do this the next time around 4 years from now.
I think what some people, in addition, might like to see is a series of really grueling interviews, you know, get some of the best journalists that we have thoroughly steeped in the issues and have them sit down with the candidates and just have them just grill these people. And if they ask a question and the candidate doesn't answer, then the reporter has the permission to say, excuse me, but that's not what I asked you. And just do it and really put the people on the spot. I wonder two things. One, whether the candidates would do it, and two, how many people actually would sit down and invest the time in watching them.
Well, I agree with you. I think it would be terrific if we could see that. And you see it in little bits and pieces. I mean, the candidates will sit down with the interviewers for short interviews, but it doesn't always allow for the level of follow-up that you need. But back to the Katie Couric-Sarah Palin interview that was mentioned a little bit ago, I think that was very instructive, even though it wasn't a long sit-down formal interview. It was very instructive in giving people information about Sarah Palin. Now, whether that was to her benefit or not is another matter, but you get what you can out of these interviews, and the press, I think, tries as much as they can to hold the candidates accountable.
Yeah, and what I think is also true over time is that the candidates are less and less willing to put themselves in situations where they don't have control.
That's right, and that's part of the thing with debates is they can't ultimately control what happens because it's live television and they're not reading the questions in advance, but they try to build in as many layers of protection and take as much of the spontaneity out of it as they can, unfortunately. But in spite of all of that, there's still an awful lot that happens in debates that does get around that level of control.
Our guest, Alan Schroeder, is associate professor in the School of Journalism at Northeastern University in Boston, has written a lot about presidential politics and the media, including his books, Presidential Debates, 40 Years of High-Risk TV, and Celebrity in Chief, How Show Business Took Over the White House. And Professor Schroeder, thank you very much.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the callers, too.